Welcome to Out of the Question, a podcast that looks behind some common questions and uncovers the question behind the question while providing real solutions for biblical world and life view. Your host is Andrea Schwartz, a teacher and mentor and founder of the Chalcedon Teacher Training Institute.
Thanks for joining me today. Hurricane Helene was a deadly and devastating tropical cyclone that caused widespread catastrophic damage and numerous fatalities across the southeastern United States in late September 2024. The video footage and photos of the devastation and the magnitude of the damage is really hard to fathom. Most recently, there have been numerous credible reports of the neglect, inefficiency, and fraud attendant with FEMA's response. Today, I have with me Joseph Foreman, a Facebook friend who I have never actually met in person, who is someone who lived in and through this disaster, but did much more than just complain about the misfortune and his own situation. He actually applied Christian charity without asking anyone's permission to do so. Joseph, thanks for joining me today.
Well, thanks for asking.
All right, before we get into the events of last year, share with my audience who you are, the worldview you operate within, and your family's unique calling and situation that enabled you to operate in real time to help real people.
Wow, I don't know where to begin. I'm an ordained minister, but I have not been the pastor of a church in the last 20 years. When we moved to this area, I was moving back to my hometown, Montreat, North Carolina, and we have a family of eight. They were mostly homeschooled, and we have been since we came back. I did everything from teach at a local high school to teach at Montreat College for about 4 or 5 years. And at that point, our eight children were getting old enough. And my wife, Ann, is a brilliantly self-taught chef with a photographic memory when it comes to food and a perfect palate. I mean, I've noticed over the years that she had those things. She would always get Christmas presents and birthday presents being cookbooks, and then the kids started competing and family members started competing to see who could make him the hairiest technical cookbook. And I noticed she would have them read within about, 2-3 days.
She actually read a cookbook?
Oh, she can.
Wow.
Yes, I know. And so all of a sudden I stopped because in college, she was not particularly academic. She comes from a very academic family. Her father is Ed Clowney of Westminster Seminary. Her brother is Peter Jones of Escondido, and her sister is Rebecca Jones. So I mean, it's a very academic family, and they all said, "Well, and you'll just be a good mom." This is back in the 60s. Uh-huh. You'll just be a good mom. Well, it turns out she is. She's an awesome mom. Eight kids, really excellent. However, I noticed since I went through college with her, and it's true. I mean, just the academic stuff in college wasn't her cup of tea. But I was noticing something going on here, which was anomalous. And so I just asked her, I said, "Do you actually know what you're reading, or are you just skimming through?" She scornfully said, "Ask me any question." So I did. And I went through two or three books. She could cite pages. And what it turned out was when she sees an ingredient, she can taste it. And when she sees them in groups, she can taste what the modified effect of the whole group would be. She can catalog that. And I suddenly said, "You know what? You've been kind of put down in these rarefied academic circles, but you've got everything a scholar has. It's just you're not interested in the things scholars are interested in. Food is your thing. And when it comes to food, you can do everything that a Class A professor in any university can do." So in about 2007, I left teaching at the college. And we started a business of her catering. The end result of that was that I started a coffee shop because I wanted an outreach ministry to the sorts of people who come into coffee shops. Uh-huh. And in the Asheville area, that's a very, shall we say, San Francisco Seattle level, you know, Greenwich Village level of clientele. Mm-hmm. I don't mean academically, I just mean spiritually and the worldview and mindset. And those are the people that I really wanted to talk to and meet and befriend and get to know on something other than, hi, I'm a professional Christian basis. So among other things, some of my friends are, one is a Buddhist priest. Another is, just go down the list of people that in other circles Christians would find fairly strange. I probably have a friend like that.
I see.
Well, that's what I've been doing for the last 25 years. The location we're at now has the Swannanoa River running behind it about, oh, maybe 45 feet down a bank that's about 30 feet from the top of the bank down to the river. And then out in front, there's a large parking area, not quite a quarter of a mile to a grocery store, which... The only reason I wasn't surprised when the grocery store got flooded and we didn't was simply because my dad always said, check to see where the 1,000-year floodplain is. Probably it's irrelevant knowledge, but it may come in handy. So at the high tide of this thing, that entire area was a lake, and our little ridge peninsula bluff on the river was just a tiny little island. One of my employees who ended up not having a place to live, I gave him my van in the back to live in. He's been living there for 2 years. Turned out the temporary housing was about what he was looking for. And so he does our dishes and basically is just a friendly guy around the place.
Okay.
But he was there that night. And I told him, I said, if the water comes up 15 feet, the current will go straight, because if it were to bend and come here, this whole bluff and everything on it would be washed away. I said, but don't worry, it will go straight. There's a floodplain over there, about another quarter of a mile on that side. And sure enough, it came up 27 feet and came within about 3 or 4 feet of the top of the bank in our parking area and the slab of our building that we're in. However, it stopped at that point, but he was definitely praying that I would be right.
Right. And your father would be right, that your father would be right.
Yes. Yes, exactly. And right. If anybody wants to see a picture of my father, you can just go right to my Facebook page and he's my icon.
Let me just say, I really appreciate how you describe yourself. Why don't you tell people how you describe yourself on your Facebook page?
I wait tables and wash dishes for the best cook and for the best chef in Western North Carolina. That's about as high praise as I ever want to receive.
I see. Okay. So during this event, this meteorological event, it seems that God had you positioned to be able to do more than just say, wow, we escaped something bad happening to us, because you looked around and you could see that other people didn't fare so well. So how did you combine the circumstances and the things that you've been doing for the past 25 years or however long it's been to actually then go out and respond to what you saw in front of you?
Immediately, I was out at 6 o'clock Friday morning. It stopped raining at about 11 o'clock Friday morning. At 6 o'clock, just trying to get out of there to see if I could go help people. We were completely, with tree falls and the flooded creek completely boxed in. The creek was flooding an area of about 100 yards, maybe 50, 75 yards on either side of it. So we were just trapped in there until some people cut literally tunnels through the trees blocking the roads. So at about noon or 1 o'clock, I was able to get out. I tried to get to Swannanoa. Swannanoa is halfway between Black Mountain, where I live, and Asheville, North Carolina, which is the town you would see on the map. There's really only two ways there, Old 70, New 70, and Interstate 40. All of those were blocked. And so I came back at about 4 o'clock, picked up Ann. We had one of our largest catering weekends of the year with her catering business that weekend. And there was a client that was in a bed and breakfast / event center, which was in the floodplain of the river. So we wanted to try and get to them because the last message that I had was, these people are cut off. Is there anything you can do? So we finally got through to them, and they're in a house perched above the flood. We asked them, hey, do you want to eat? It was about 6 o'clock at night. And they said, yes. And so Ann went back to our kitchen. There was no power. And to our shock, we discovered there was gas still flowing. And we figured it must be some mistake, but as long as it was going, we then found out the gas company does it on purpose because they said there's so many people digging everywhere that they'll break through a gas line. And if they turn it back on later, they won't know the gas is escaping. So I'm not sure how this works, but they just leave the gas on in emergencies like this. So we had gas and so did a number of other eating places in Black Mountain. And so we cooked them literally their whole menu for the wedding reception. And Ann prepared it. She was running around the kitchen with her little 3-inch flashlight, just seeing how everything, that's the only light we had in there. We had no emergency lighting. We had no nothing. And she put the whole meal together. The river was still up about halfway down our bank. And she put that meal together. We loaded it up and I took it over to them. And they were just blown away because they had their entire contracted meal. It wasn't for 200 people, but it was for the people who were there. They had that. We asked them if they wanted anything to drink. And they said, no, they had the liquid courage, all the liquid courage they needed. and so we were good. So that took care of them. We had a job the next day. Ann goes down into Black Mountain and to the White Horse and said, hey, you have a wedding here. We're supposed to cater it. And they said, yeah, fine. We tracked down the wedding people. They moved the venue. And so we moved it to another location. And then she fed about 50 people with about 150 people's worth of food. Because what they then did is they took it out to just people in Black Mountain who were able to feast from about 5 to 7 o'clock. Then at that point, with all the extra food we had for this weekend, she started cooking it. She probably fed another 1,500 people with just the food we had. And we worked with our local church. Now, I've gotten through Friday and Saturday. It's now Sunday. There still was no evidence that anybody even knew that we had a problem here in this area. It was very slow to respond. And our church, which is also in Swannanoa, started getting in on Sunday and Monday, just truckloads of stuff coming in. And at first I thought, wow, I must be attending the super church of Western North Carolina. And it turned out we were totally average. Other than the fact, I think it's cool that they also got the mule teams to come in to take literally mules and mule back stuff up into the unreachable places from helicopter or anywhere else and get the mules up there. And I think it was our church that got them in. I know that the mule, I don't know if they call them mule skinners or what, but anyway, the wranglers were there around the church for a few days. And I remember every time they would come in, they'd be very, I don't know how to say it, irritated, ornery, because at first I just thought they were irritated, ornery people. And then I realized they wanted to be out there and they resented any minute that they had to be coming back for supplies before going out again. There was a very interesting attitude because most of us were, you know, fairly jovial about all the stuff that we were doing. But they were like, we've got to get to these people. And they were extremely intense and didn't like any of our ha 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 or ho ho ho. Well, what happened is literally the sanctuary and the fellowship hall were filled with stuff. And as I said, at first I thought, wow, look at us. And then I realized as I would drive around, this stuff was sprouting in every church. So by the time Wednesday came around, it was Wednesday and Thursday that I believe FEMA finally made it in. By the way, the Canadian version of FEMA was there, and they were telephone line people. They were there on Saturday after the crisis and working on there was not a power line that was up, as near as I could tell, anywhere I went in the county. The lines were down. There may be a pole up here and there, but they were just down flat. And they were there. They figured out how to get there. They were putting up lines madly as fast as they could from dawn to dusk. And our U.S. response FEMA was just parked waiting to come in. They were parked down at the bottom of Interstate 40. You first come up into the mountains dramatically up Interstate 40, and it's kind of like, I don't know how to describe it. You're just coming up into the Blue Ridge Mountains, into the Appalachians. And they were down at the bottom of a town called Old Fort because Interstate 40 was a block somewhere on that mountain. It would be very simple. You just take 221 to 74 to 26 and come up that way. I realize it's a convoy, but they could have been up there by a Sunday noon if they had just gotten off their butts and gone.
Okay, so let me stop you for a second, Joseph, because I'm kind of confused. So I pictured after this all happened, the only way to get around was by boat. So apparently the water receded enough that you could drive around, correct?
Yes. The upside and downside of mountainous floods, the downside is when the water comes through, it rips out everything in its path. It's not like the Mississippi floodplains, which is, it basically rises and there's a gentle current, but rather it is moving 40 miles an hour. I mean, it is tearing everything up, tearing it through, grabbing houses, moving them off their foundations, taking trailer parks, which are very often in the lower lands, and just literally rolling the trailers away. And they're also technically moored down, but they can't, it's a strong rush. The upside of it is, by the time it stops raining, everything visibly just starts receding, and it just goes down. So within 12 hours, it's just down to, you know, it's a rushing stream, but it's no longer any threat to anybody as long as you stay out of it.
So the real problem is downed trees, obstructions in your way, and having to get around those obstructions.
And that was interesting. I mean, that was kind of picturesque because people would just cut little tunnels in the trees that you could drive a single car to, and then people would stack up behind the tunnels and have to go through one at a time. So it just gave a surrealistic sense of the whole landscape, that everywhere you went, you were constantly, you know, going through these little tree tunnels that people had cut. And I never understood why they only cut a little tunnel. But anyway, those were up for about a week. And then they gradually got broadened.
Oh, okay. Let me stop you again, because I'm really trying to get a picture here. Do people, I mean, is cutting tunnels in trees something that people are familiar with doing? Or did someone say, you know what, we could get through if we just cut a tunnel through this tree?
The second part, trees have obviously been down here like probably anywhere else in America after you get a strong wind or something like that. But this was, you couldn't go 200 yards without a tree down on the road. Everything being done was local people. The fire department, the police department was completely tied up. I don't think you didn't hear a siren from somebody for the entire first week and well into the second week. And it wasn't until the third week that there'd be periods of time that you wouldn't hear a siren, and then one would start up again. And by siren, I mean from a police cars, fire trucks, that sort of thing.
Well, what were they
doing? They were just going, honestly, I don't know, but they were headed towards the true crisis areas where a life and limb were at stake. People were trapped, and they just found out about it.
I see.
And by the way, the local fire departments and also police departments were joined by elements from literally all over the country. We had people in from Chicago. There's actually kind of a funny story in terms of how big cities versus little cities handle things. And that is that at the grocery store, it's a big regular grocery store across the street from where our coffee shop is. And our coffee shop is Moments, if anybody wants to stop by. But across the street from there, the mud was like 6 inches thick and it hadn't been cleaned off. And that's the whole parking lot. And a crowd of people were gathering, I believe it was Sunday morning, wanting to get in because they wanted food. And the churches had just started setting up feeding. I didn't mention that by the time Monday came, literally you couldn't go by a driveway on any main street that didn't have somebody cooking food and giving out free meals for people. And it was about 90% the church. So powerful was the witness. I mean, it's like there wasn't a church that wasn't doing this. And the churches had connections outside the area, so there's always food coming in through them, that a lot of people who were in no way interested in religion of any sort, they had been fairly burned over. They had probably grew up fundamentalist Christian, left that, became some sort of a Buddhist, some sort of a New Age, probably tried out the various liberal or conservative conspiracy groups. There's a lot of people like that that have sort of been dabbled in everything, and they're like done with anything that's ideologically driven. And they were saying, wow, we had no idea Christians were like this. This is amazing. Maybe God is somebody that I need to look into again. I mean, that was a very common thing people were saying.
You know, and that's just what the scripture says will happen. You know, you help somebody instead of just saying, I'll pray for you, brother, that you're actually helping them.
Right. 10 Gentiles will grab a hold of the cloak of one Jew and say, take us with you, for God is with you.
Right.
And they could see that evidence. And it didn't matter what the, I mean, if there was a church, liberal, conservative, anything, they had helping hands out there. And they were actively, I think our church did more of this than most churches, but a lot of churches, we were sending supplies into the mountainous areas. If you want to picture Western North Carolina, Buncombe County is the county that's right in the middle of Western North Carolina. That's where Asheville is, mm-hmm. Asheville, North Carolina. And around it are a string of what I call border counties. I don't know if anybody else does, but they're just single counties between Buncombe County and the Virginia, Tennessee, and Georgia borders, South Carolina too. So it borders all those states. And those mountains are the real Little Abner. Well, I mean, not anymore, but back in the day, back when, I don't know how old you are, but back when I was a kid, and I grew up in this area. I mean, it was genuinely that kind of hard pressed communities. But in the intervening time, a lot of people wanting to get away from civilization and from all the stuff that cities represent has started communes, community projects. They've just moved out there to run their family farm, things like that. So it's not just that a sort of indigenous mountain people, but those are the areas out there. And we were sending regularly every day of about 10 or 15 van loads out into those areas, plugging into the churches out there and finding out where these could best be used. We started out just being told, get a car full of water and food and feminine supplies and baby supplies and all that sort of thing, and drive out to your neighborhood and just go door to door and take note of who needs what and who wants a regular visit with food and supplies. And so we all did that. And within probably a week or two, all those people around us in our church area were fairly well taken care of. But I mean, long before that, we were sending people out into the hinterlands. I have one or two stories that are actually funny stories from that, and also a lot of really grim stories that came out of that. One, there was a lighter story. There are two old men, 70, 80 years old, who lived up this single road in just two houses up there, and that was all that was left of their family and upbringing. And when they woke up in the morning, everything was washed out completely, and they just thought the end of the world had come. Well, one of them thought it was the rapture, and was convinced that he had been left behind, and he was absolutely devastated. The other one didn't think it was a rapture, but thought that the world had ended. So they got two inner tubes that they had, The one of them, when their grandkids would visit, they'd go tubing on the river down the hill. And so they got those and couldn't take much with them. So the one who wasn't waiting for the rapture corded together of about 15 six packs. And they went down to the river and just hopped into the river and paddled down the river. Well, fortunately, it was fairly temperate weather, so they didn't die of hypothermia. But they were on the river for about 22 hours, and the one waiting for the rapture figured he'd been left behind, so that means he can't be saved. So he enjoyed the first beer he's ever had in his life.
Oh, how
funny.
Well,
by the time they got down to Irwin, which would mean they had fed into the Nolichucky, they got fished out by the And by the way, the flooding in Irwin flooded out the entire first floor of their hospital. That's how high up it came. So, I mean, it was a hard hit area, too. I believe it's the home of the Clinchfield Railroad or the Southern or something like that, or at least it was. But other than that, it's also snake handling country. For those of you who have heard of that, they got fished out. And the firemen are trying to talk this guy into saying, hey, the rapture hasn't come. And one of them said, look, I'm a preacher. And if the rapture came, and the guy just interrupts him and says, you're exactly the people who would be left behind, you hypocrites. And the guy says, you're calling me a hypocrite? You got left behind too. Anyway, they finally sorted it all out. As I say, that was one of the funnier, happier stories. But I had a friend who came into Moments about 5 weeks afterwards, and I said, man, you have lost weight. What happened? He says, well, I just got out of the hospital. A mudslide had hit his house and slammed it down, and he had been knocked out of the house and was pinned in a pine tree and had about 38 broken bones and was just pinned there. His neighbors came by from the other side of the river. This is down Highway 9, if anybody's familiar with the area. He was caught in a pine tree. There was another mudslide of the main branch coming down, and he literally watched the mudslide rumbling down within 5 or 10 feet of him, but it didn't take his tree out. So that's the only reason he survived. His neighbor comes and hooks him into a sling and personally walks him across the still flooded river to a field. He gets picked up by a chopper and gets taken to Mission Hospital. The quote unquote friend then goes back. Apparently the friend was a serious drug addict and starts going through the remains of his house and finds all of his credit cards. So the guy comes to in the hospital and discovered that the man who saved his life has now spent run up about a $5,000 or $10,000 bill on the credit cards.
Oh my.
And so he was in the very awkward position of having to put the man who saved his life behind bars for theft. And I thought, you know, you just don't anticipate having to do things like this. So you're
not going through life
under normal circumstances.
Right. Let me just add here, and I'll let you continue with other stories. But I found out about what you were doing through a Facebook post of a mutual friend. And he started a fundraiser for people to help give you guys the resources to have supplies to keep going. How did that end up turning out? Did you get a good response?
For us, yes, we did get a good response, and we got enough to tide us through. The coffee shop could open, which is more than all but about 4 or 5 businesses in Swannanoa could say. Most of them were in the lowlands and just were completely flooded up 10 feet high. We could open, but there are a number of things we had to set up, like getting a water supply so that we would have clean water. And then the health department would not approve of water that had been tested by the state every day. It had to be a particularly sourced water. We finally got that kind of water. It had to be transported to the shop. So we were finally able to get open within about 3.5-4 weeks. Again, going through all the red tape of the health department. I mean, everybody's drinking this water. And if all we did was just give the water away, then there'd be no problem. But if you sell the water somehow, like in coffee, you can't do that, apparently. So it was all potable water. So I then had to buy a truck, and I was able to get a very nice Ford F-150 for about $2,500. It was very nice having a truck. And then I was also able to haul things for people, but I was also able to haul the water to feed our water tanks so that we could wash our dishes. That's the big use of the water, mop our floors and actually have potable water for people to be able to drink. So we hooked it in there, and a lot of that was done for us for free by our local help in our church and volunteers. But then just being able to pay to be able to put people back to work so that they could have an income stream. And the business really has just barely begun to pick up just now. So it's kind of tided us through. It helped us get over the worst part of it when there were just expenses, which we had to, I mean, my landlord trying to collect, for instance, and he was in Europe the whole time. And
interesting.
And I just told him, I said, you know what, we don't have any income stream, and you haven't been here to do anything other than say, pay me my money. And you're right. Maybe you could evict us. I don't know. You'll just have to decide what you want to do. But we then had to start paying our rent in November and everything else that goes with running a business, the rent, the food, and so forth. What we wanted to do was the more we can get back into business and become a normal flow of things happening, just the better it is for the community. And so we wanted to provide places where people could just come, relax. If anybody wanted, you know, said, hey, I can't afford a coffee, I just told the baristas they can't afford a coffee and a latte, I just make one for them. It's not a big deal. So that's how we got ourselves back on our feet. And that money was a greatly appreciated. I think it was about a total of the people helping about $4,000, $5,000. I mean, it was not a huge amount. And to be honest, I felt guilty about doing anything to aid, help out fundraising, because it was like, if anybody wanted to help us, they'd be helping us. We weren't really in a distribution place able to get, I don't know how to say it. The things we were doing was things a private person would do or you would do in connection with your church. I had enough to do just to get the business back on its feet.
What I appreciated about the appeal, and my husband and I said, of course, we're going to help this effort, is that when you're not there, yes, you certainly can pray for people, but if then you can tangibly say, all right, if this person is trying to help people get food and the resources they need, there's that involvement. And I do think that, and this is something I wanted to ask you, it's very easy to say people are selfish, people are self-centered, but you got a firsthand view of how willing people, not people with labels, people were willing to chip in and help. Did that change your view on hope for the future?
Change would be a strong word for it, but it made me much more hopeful that at least the Christians got it figured out. What it was is the churches constituted two things. One is organizational feet on the ground, and then they also constituted people who were willing to branch out from there, who were very intimately aware of. For instance, I took care of four older Black women in the community who, interestingly enough, even after the soup kitchens were set up in Black Mountain and that was just a going thing, they didn't feel comfortable going down and standing in line at all in that situation. And they never said anything, but they were more than happy for me to just bring it to them. And so I did. I just took care of them, made sure they had what they needed. And so for about 2 weeks, I was their connection. And that's a story that's just multiplied. What I was doing was not unique. It's like everybody was doing this for their neighbors. Those who had connections were connecting for everybody around them. And we were getting gasoline into our neighbors who had generators, for instance. And then the other aspect of it is, the churches here were connected with churches all over the nation. So as soon as they got word out, which wasn't based on the disaster, it was based on their connections with each other. If you get the difference. In other words, people weren't looking at the news and going, oh, we got to do something about this. This word got out and stuff was coming in around the time that the news cycle finally picked up there was a problem, Wednesday, Thursday, and so forth. But the indigenous, the natural, the existing connection of Christian to Christian got word out instantly, and stuff started coming in Saturday noon and just in a steady flood from then until for the next 4 weeks. And then all of a sudden, churches were saying, whoa, what are we going to do with all this stuff? And that became another problem. it was almost it's the 12 baskets left over. Do you think the apostles thought that day they were going to be carrying this load of food out of the camp meeting? What do we do with all this stuff, Jesus? It went from how do you feed so many with so few to now what are we going to do with all this extra food? It was that kind of a situation to where all sorts of people wanted to help. A lot of people would call, and so what I did is just got the people who were deploying people out there in touch with those who were deploying them. And we had four or five people in our church that were just outstanding. What would you call them? Center mids, if it was a soccer team, just distributors. They just understood how to network and how to get stuff out there and who to call when there was a problem. You know, these gifts, I never knew they had. And yet all of a sudden they're wheeling and dealing and just making it happen. It was so gratifying. Yes, it really made me feel like we're in much better shape than I think a lot of doomsday people like I used to be.
Let me just say this. It's so easy, especially if you spend any time on social media, to see people just arguing theology. You're right, I'm wrong, or I'm right, and you're wrong, and whatever it is. But when the rubber met the road, you didn't have people saying, oh, do you believe in infant baptism? Okay, then I can't work with you. Or do you believe in children? You know, in other words, it became, what are we supposed to do based on who we are as Christians? And I think events like this help advance the kingdom because we move it outside of our head and debating and get it into real life situations.
My wife's in the other room. I just heard her say amen. I'm a survivor of Operation Rescue back in the day. And we saw the exact same thing there, that when you get into a jail cell with Catholics, Pentecostals, Wisconsin-centered Lutherans, good old Orthodox Presbyterians, all of a sudden, it's not even all of a sudden, we're just worshiping God. And it's a whole different atmosphere. And even the theological debates that took place were constructive. It was very helpful. And I don't know that anybody got their mind changed particularly, but everybody got an understanding of what the faith is all about.
What's valuable about what you have to offer, Joseph, is that you were there. It's so easy to abstract this is what you should do or not. If you had to say what people who were affected by this adversely, were they expecting the state to come in and help them, and then when they weren't there, they didn't know what they were going to do? Or did they respond to the fact that, wow, somebody who isn't official, who isn't getting paid to do this, is helping us? Did it sort of break people from that?
Yes. In fact, one of the really interesting things, as you know, I spend a lot of time with very left-wing liberals who are still idealistic. They're young. I didn't find anybody who appreciated what the state was doing, not even trying to make the best of it. You know, well, they're trying. And so I used it as an opportunity just to share with people what matters is that we are together doing everything that you just said. And as soon as you try to organize into state level response, you end up really with a sitting duck for corruption. You bring in, just like we did. I don't think that the FEMA people up near the top were particularly, you know, the conspiracy FEMA stuff. It wasn't that. It's just, it's like in peacetime, you put your incompetent people in charge of the army because you don't really need the army. But when wartime comes around, you look for your Bradleys and your people who actually know what to do with the military corps. And I think FEMA is very similar, that it's a place where basically incompetent people are put who are very susceptible to power tripping, and the disaster response rules, which are pretty harsh, they come in thinking that you don't have to know what the situation is. You just come in, you commandeer stuff. For instance, they went up and down the streets telling everybody who was out there preparing food for people on the street. They didn't find Anne in her kitchen. Anne, by the way, cooked for an entire week in the dark, just running around with flashlights. And we had to bring in crews to wash, who had to bring in all their own water. That's another whole story. But FEMA went out to the people you could see with their grills set up and lines, and tried to shut them down, saying that their food wasn't vouched for. You know, it wasn't State Department of Health certified safe. And they tried to shut down a whole fire department in Haywood County. And the response by, I think, everybody was to say, yes, sir. And as soon as they left, to go back to cooking and handing out food. Because part of it is, that's how we do things in the mountains. It's a part of the world where people have been moving here since colonial times, precisely to get away from organized government. So there's a broad personality that says you do what you got to do to get the job done and try to be polite to the people around you because they're probably related to somebody you know. Mm-hmm. That's just sort of a mountain common sensism. So even though it's not true of the FEMA people, it's just a yes or yes or yes, ma'am. And when they're gone, you just do what you got to do.
Let me ask you this, Joseph. Were you ever overwhelmed?
I wasn't because when you get overwhelmed, I started learning this assisting and having babies. I did quite a bit of that. And I realized that if I felt her pain, I couldn't be there for what I needed to do to help her. And she actually was in pain. And so that's always been kind of a disaster response I've always had, whether I'm in jail or whether we lost our house, as has happened once. You know, you hold it together because you've got to be thinking about what we do next. So from that perspective, I was never emotionally overwhelmed. I mean, Anne's also that kind of person. And she just said, what do we do next? And I had to talk her out of driving things around to all the neighbors. I said, I'll do that. You work on other aspects of it. Mm-hmm. One of the responses that I kept running into was people who were afraid for their children, didn't want to go out and hand out food with their children because they somehow afraid of what the response was going to be or something. And that was something I didn't understand because I would just encourage if everybody says, what do I do with my kids? How can I help them grow up? And to be Christian. And I would say, well, find your nearest soup kitchen and get them involved. You get involved, hand out blankets on the street in the winter. That was one of the things that changed my oldest son's life. As a 6-year-old, he saw this thing of freezing people on the news when we lived in Philadelphia. And he said, Dad, this is terrible. We ought to do something. I said, what would you like to do? You like to take blankets? So we went out and bought blankets and took them downtown one night. And by the way, that actually was a dangerous thing to do with your kid. But so I couldn't see how Christians, I mean, they all did the right thing. Okay. This is not a criticism. It's just, we need to realize that this is what our kids need to be involved with and to see firsthand, and at the very least to see you involved in it. But certainly it's the sort of thing that you can take them with you. Just for example, if your kids go up to the house and knock on the door, it's considerably less threatening to the people who are inside.
Yes.
And if you're sitting there afraid of the people inside, believe me, they're more afraid of us. Because, you know, there's a disaster. They truly are overwhelmed. And so it's just a way of being able to break things down. And I found the kids that actually got involved and the parents got them involved, that really changed the lives of the kids, the families, the youth groups. The two established colleges in the area sent all their kids home because all the parents were terrified and wanted them out of there. And so it took away some of the most helpful people that there could have been involved. Whereas there's this one little Christian college that has probably about 100 kids going to it. It's sort of a homeschool college for homeschool kids. I hire some of them to work for me. And they set up this thing that turned into this huge relief medical clinic and everything else. And one of them had a drone and was flying. He got his footage on CNN and all that kind of stuff. But his drone was able to go up and just find things or confirm that everything was in a particular area, there wasn't anybody there in need, and then go on to another area. He was able to fly the drone and just move and take care of just methodically about square mile areas so they could be sure they got everybody. But that college kept their kids there, and the kids became instrumental in everything that needed to be doing in a disaster.
We're going to close this up because I promised you I'd keep it to about an hour. And you told me you didn't think you had a lot to say. Well, I think we've both proved you wrong. We could keep talking about things that you experienced. But getting back to who you are and how you view the world in terms of what God requires of you, clearly, looking at the photos, and I'm sure living through it, you have to say, this is not blessing. This is judgment.
And yeah,
we know that there's ample reason, if you look at the Word of God, as to things that are happening all over our nation, let alone the world, that are not in conformity with God's Word. However, it sounds to me that Romans 8:28 was very operationally visible that God worked all things together for the good, because the church shined. Let's forget about all the things that we could criticize individual churches for. But as you at least intimated, the people who were helped, who were joining the help, had a different view of what it means to be a Christian. Talk a little bit about that in terms of how your worldview gave you the strength, impetus, and know-how to do what you did.
Well, I'm Reformed. I'm a Calvinist. And so there was never a doubt in my mind, in my wife's mind, in our family's mind, that God had everything completely under control. And that would include if something happened to any one of us and we were to die or be injured, we knew that, no matter where we were, what we were doing, or the way I like to put it is, if you end up in a hospital, you know that God has a hospital ministry for you. Mm-hmm. That there are people all up and down the hall that need you to come in and pray with them. And the only way he's going to get you there is by breaking your leg or something like that. That wouldn't get you in a hospital, but you know what I mean.
No, I understand that
we wouldn't be there to be visited. We would be there to visit, because that's the best way to get in. If you get thrown into jail, then that's the best way to start a prison ministry. And I spent a good chunk of my life in jail. And it's like wherever you find yourself, because God has you in his hand, nothing's going to come along that's going to shake that. And whether you go through the whole thing as we did with no injuries, or you end up like my friend did, breaking 38 bones, he ended up and started a hospital ministry while he was there. That's what Christians do. So from our perspective, that is the sovereignty of God at work, creating opportunities for us as creatures in his image to be able to take dominion of creation, however we can, whatever parts of it, and then use that superiority of dominion we might have in that, you know, a church full of stuff to hand out, to then go and meet the needs of people all around us. So that's the biblical Trinitarian model of not I'm in charge of you, but rather whatever I have that you might need, I can bring it to you to meet your needs, and I can serve you in that way. And there doesn't need to be somebody telling me to know the Lord. There simply needs to be people with the ethical self-control, understanding God's law in their heart, going out and just transforming the world all around us. And when there's a disaster, it's always a very dramatic way to be able to do that. When there's not a disaster, that's what we do when we go to work. It's no different. It's just not a disaster. We're taking dominion. We're using the tools God's given us to be able to bring blessing into the lives of others. I tell all of my baristas, even the ones who are in no way Christian, they're incredibly hostile. You would say they're woke, and tell them our model for taking care of people is Jesus Christ, because he's somebody who met people where they were and ministered to their needs. And that's what we're going to do as baristas. That's what we do as a coffee shop. And at first they're kind of bristly. And I said, no, we're not Baptist ministers who are having a tent meeting. We want to be like Jesus, to receive people as we would like to be received, and to receive people and find out what their needs are and meet them. That's what we're here for. And it's a whole different way that they've never heard anything really positive about Jesus or Christians. And it sort of takes them by surprise. But whether it's in a peacetime setting or in a full war setting where the world has just come to an end, as those two guys up the creek said,
right.
That our job is to use whatever ability, whatever preference, whatever power, whatever status, whatever thing God has put into our hands, even if it's the jawbone of an ass, to go down and do what needs to be done with the gifts as we have, 5 loaves and 7 fishes, approach to life.
Joseph, it seems to me how you prepare to do that is to take every word that comes from God, which is the words of Scripture, and seek to apply it. I started off by saying that you and other Christians manifested Christian charity without asking anyone's permission. Well, you didn't have to ask anyone's permission because you're receiving the command to go make disciples. So we've already been commissioned.
Yes.
You were just taking that situation or the situation of running your coffee shop. And I think it's a kick that you will hire people who aren't necessarily Christian. I imagine after hanging around with you for a while, they're at least investigating it. So it's a great way to introduce people that you're doing this 24/7. You don't have to say, oh, I hope I can kick into gear if something bad happens. You're already in gear.
Right, absolutely. We should be doing in a catastrophe whatever we would be doing tomorrow in a normal day. It's the same theology, the same God, the same people who need Jesus Christ.
All right. Well, you mentioned your Facebook page. I mean, and I don't know if your coffee shop has a Facebook page. If somebody says, I need to get to know this guy a little bit better, just remind them how they might do that.
I am technology illiterate, but 8 years ago, somebody set up a Facebook page for me. Unfortunately, you won't find a whole lot in there about what a happy, friendly family I am, but you will find a lot of my ideas in there because I just use it to talk ideas, to talk the kingdom. What's kingdom talk?
How about your actual business? If somebody said, this sounds like an interesting thing, are you open to talking to them about how you started this kingdom business?
Absolutely. It's Moments Coffee Shop. It's Ann's Custom Catering. She says coffee bar. I think that if you Google any of those things,
how do you spell that first word you said?
Moments. Take a moment and think about this. Yeah, it's Moments. It's right there in Swannanoa. I don't know what comes up on a Google search, but I do think you'll find a website. And Moments does have a Facebook page, I was just told.
Okay, well, very good.
But can I just say one more small thing?
Oh, absolutely.
You know, we live in a world of locks and keys, and we're very careful. In fact, one of the illustrations of why people want to close the border is because you wouldn't leave your house unlocked. You know, I mean, that's we're very careful, and we spend our whole lives careful to protect our things. And what struck me is I'm driving up and down really all just miles and miles of roads that literally the houses have everything that was in them stripped out and just dumped in a pile next to the roads. And the piles were so high, you couldn't see over them as you drive past to even see the houses they came out of. And just the roads are just lined with the stuff that millions of dollars were spent protecting. And here it is out on the street corner. And the other funny thing is there's nobody tempted to steal any of it. It's like that was your life. And it's like on the one hand, there's a tragedy, but I would just encourage people, don't wait until your stuff is flooded and piled out on the edge of the road. Don't wait for then to assess, who am I in Christ? What is it he's called me to? What of this stuff do I need? What use is being made of it for God's kingdom? I'm not sure how to apply it in someone else's life, but it just struck me that here we were. And another totally arcane point is the name of the hurricane was Helene. And in many ways, we've been captured by Greek thinking, and it's made a wreckage of a lot of the gospel. And we need to really take dominion there. Helene is the word for Greek, elas.
Right, Hellenic thought, things like that.
Right, Hellenic thought, and it just struck me that there's a lot of work we need to do as scholars, as people, as thinkers, as people living in the moment, and just taking dominion of all creation. So there you have it. I don't have much negative material on how bad FEMA was.
I don't care.
Or how bad the government response was. Exactly.
Right.
And I can't tell you how many of these I've turned down because the people were looking for grist for their mill. You're the only one I've ever talked to like this.
Right. Well, let's put it this way.
On a podcast or something.
You can spend your time pulling weeds, or you can plant. And you and the people around you who were self-consciously applying what it means to be a Christian were planting things. And I imagine, if you haven't already seen it, you will see the fruit of your efforts. And that's just how the kingdom grows.
It is. I hope the same thing's happening in California, too. Southern Cal.
Yeah. Yeah. No doubt it is. I mean, if you just watch the news, you wouldn't know that. But yeah.
If you watch the news here, you wouldn't know it either.
Yeah, right. Because that's another story for another conversation. Anyway, thanks again, Joseph. I appreciate it.
Thanks.
for those of you who have tuned in, if you want to comment on this or you just want to talk about or ask us to talk about things you'd like to talk about, outofthequestionpodcast@gmail.com is how you reach us. And we'll talk to you next time.
Thanks for listening to Out of the Question. For more information on this and other topics, please visit calcedon.edu.